I guess it's on me tonight. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of No Driving Gloves. We are always happy to be here with the No Driving Gloves community, and hope everyone out there is doing well. Guys, while we're broadcasting tonight, jump in the comments. We like to hear what you have to say. We have some interesting topics tonight, I think. Hopefully some of you noticed the posts on the socials. I'm going to say we're going to bring the bling tonight. Some talk about some gold cars that have made the news lately. But let's see, John is back, and let's see how his microphone's doing.
Do I sound like a robot?
Holy cow, it sounds like John is back. Look at that. No staticky weirdness. I was just mentioning, John, that tonight, after a little bit of discussion and some other topics, we're going to be bringing the bling.
Oh, yes, we are. It's Gold Rush time. And I'm not talking about the Discovery Channel show that for some reason I started watching again.
Yeah, you're binging things again? Great.
Yeah. I have to pick shows she's absolutely not going to be interested in. Or otherwise, I'm just going to watch an episode and a few days later it doesn't matter. That's personal life. Let's talk cars. Let's talk about how we were right last week.
Exactly. I mean, when are we not right, John?
First of all, I don't know, but I know some of you watch the video stream. I don't know if any of you caught the audio podcast. But while we were standing here 1 week ago, right about this time, bitching about the Malibu and General Motors going, cars don't sell anymore. Jim Farley. That's right, isn't it? Jim Farley of Ford.
Is Ford, yes.
Made an announcement that we're probably going to see a Mustang sedan in 2025 as a 2026. Hybrid and gasoline powered. Four-door Mustang, not a Mach-E, but a car, four-door Mustang. Now, take it for you what you want. A Mustang shouldn't be four-door. It's not a performance car, blah, blah, blah. Panamera is a pretty bad car, but a pretty badass car, let's say that. I don't care.
I was going to say, which way are you using bad? Like, it's a pretty bad car. It's a pretty bad car.
But it doesn't matter. Ford's sitting here saying, hey, we've got cars coming again. And General Motors going, we can't sell cars. We can't sell cars. I don't know.
John, did you see what came out of General Motors 4 days ago?
The four-door Camaro.
Well, yes, but there was something else hidden that is now being talked about slightly officially and slightly unofficially by General Motors. In a Mary Barra press conference, there was a background image, and it included all of the GM brand logos, including one that we haven't seen in a few years, the Pontiac Arrowhead.
Well, what was?
And there is rumor coming out of General Motors that the Pontiac brand will be coming back and may be the sedan plan for General Motors in the future.
It would be interesting to see. I guess I was on Indeed today and came across a listing for a position at a local dealership that was a Hyundai Oldsmobile affiliate. Kind of caught me off guard there, and I hadn't researched it much further to see if Oldsmobile was going, what?
But well, we'll need to research that one, John, because one of the brands, and I think it may have been Oldsmobile, General Motors actually lost that name because they didn't hold on to the copyright the way they were supposed to. And I think it might have been Oldsmobile that someone else grabbed the rights to the name. Don't take me for 100% here until we do some research, but I do recall something around, I believe it was the Oldsmobile name, and some copyright issues that GM may have messed up on holding on to the name. So just for anybody listening to the audio that's not here tonight, when you hear this, I'm going to make this comment because Jason just made a sarcastic comment in our comments section. That's a lot of comments. Jason, you're fired.
Are you commenting about Jason's comment in the comment section?
Yes, I'm making a commentary on the comment. And Jason said, will it be a 2024 and a half Mustang? And Jason's fired. So.
No, Jason, it'll probably be a 2025 and a half, just to rub it in a little bit more.
Yeah, really mess it up. So anyway, I just wanted to make sure I got that in there, John, because there is what appears to be some hope coming out of General Motors that we may see a car lineup again. And how cool, at least for me, would it be that it would come out under the Pontiac brand? Because depending on what they bring out, they might have another buyer right here.
Well, I also read the statistic today that the average age of a car on the road right now is 12 and a half years, or the average age of any SUV or light truck, half-ton pickup truck, is 9.5 years. Yes, people just don't want to get rid of their cars.
So, and the average age of the cars on Derek's property is about 98 years.
I'm saying the average age of car buyers are probably about 72. But no, it's just kind of interesting to see. I just like that little bit. And then to even go further is today's auto file from Reuters talks a little bit about this EV tariff thing, and the European auto manufacturers are lobbying no tariffs on Chinese vehicles.
And, really, you know, John? What is their reasoning for that? Why would someone not? Why would a country or an entire continent like Europe not want to have tariffs on something like Chinese EVs? Could you enlighten us?
Well, the Stellantis CEO Carlos Tavares said that they're a trap. It would fuel inflation and depress European demand and give false hope that European automakers and suppliers could avoid reactions by the Chinese government in possible import tariffs to China, which could be really interesting now that we're talking about, we were just talking about GM, and what if China retaliates to us? What's that going to do to, say, Buick, which is a fairly large export to China from the U.S.? And the executives of Volkswagen, Renault said that the Chinese competitors will just localize production in Europe, negating any tariffs. Didn't we say something about that in Mexico and the U.S. Yeah. tariffs? It seems somebody listened to our podcast last week and rolled with it in Europe and all of a sudden said, hey, let's slow down here. Let's back the truck up. And then, of course, there's a little bit of whining coming from the U.S. because now we've got this 25% tariff on batteries. And guess what? Still, a lot of our batteries that go into electric cars come from China. So batteries go up 25%. Retail price of batteries in cars goes up 50%. Mm-hmm. Electric cars get more expensive because of the whole deal. And the article does conclude, this is an election year in the U.S. and Europe. Standing up to China is one thing that both the left and right agree on in both markets. I guess, though, you need to really look at, you know, not being Democratic, Republican, independent, pro-EV, anti-EV. Got to look at the whole picture. Careful. It's my biggest saying. I probably just get it tattooed across my chest. Careful what you wish for. It might happen.
Yeah, but then nobody can read it. It's got to be on your forehead, John. But interesting that the politicians are the ones wanting to stand up to China, and manufacturers are saying, hold on here. Well, this could cause problems. I find that interesting. I don't know if anybody else does, but I do.
Oh, yeah. I guess it was the same article that I came with a car statistic. The average age of a new car is a record. Our car in the U.S. market's 12.6 years.
Yeah. And a comment from one of our listeners here, Hernando Pizarro. Hopefully I'm saying that correctly. Vehicles last longer and are more expensive. So owners are repairing them and maintaining them longer versus eager to get into outrageous payments. It's exactly right. I mean, Hernando's kind of hitting the nail on the head here. And that's what you know, we talked about last week what we're talking about here, you know, especially with these Chinese tariffs. John just explained it. Battery tariff, 25%. Well, the battery coming from China going into your Tesla or whatever other electric you're getting, well, they got to charge you more now because they had to pay more for the battery, so on and so forth. And car payments are going up. Car costs are going up. It just all comes down to things being more expensive. And, you know, the other thing I was thinking about in this, John, with that statistic is it would be interesting to maybe do a study of some kind or see someone do a study. You know, travel was reduced during the COVID period, right? We didn't work, you know, employment was, let me start that over. You know, people weren't necessarily traveling to their jobs. They weren't traveling as much. Mm-hmm. We didn't put as many miles on cars. So I'm, you know, in my head, I started to wonder if there's a factor there that, you know, people just didn't wear their cars out as much or put as many miles on during COVID. So they're holding on to them a little longer because they didn't drive as far in these cars recently.
Well, so you do have
interesting.
You do have that COVID factor that comes into a lot of things because, first of all, people held on to their cars because there were no cars to buy. Right now, there's you know, it looks like everything stabilized a little bit now that we're 2 years, 3 years beyond COVID, but we're still having a shortage of cars coming off lease, et cetera, because not a lot of cars were leased during that vehicle shortage period. And ironically, in this article, we could even go on to where it covers that it seems that U.S. dealers are back to having decent inventory levels because there's a lot of Memorial Day sales happening right now and incentives to buy cars this, you know, in this coming week. And Hernando might be right because just tonight I dropped my car off to have something looked at on the little Ford. I mean, geez, I've put 60,000 miles on the thing since I bought it. And I've got a really interesting problem. Sounds like a rod knock, but it's when I opened up the hood, it wasn't a rod knock. The whole radiator, condenser, cooling fan assembly is just bouncing around like crazy, clicking away. And I don't know what the issue is, and I don't want to deal with it. It's hot outside. So I did drop it off to see, spend the $150 to find out how expensive it's going to be to fix before I rush out and buy a replacement car. Normally, I would just go buy a replacement car. So even I've stepped back because I honestly looked at some used cars, and I just don't want to pay for them. Too damn much money. So he's right. Even me, who looks for any excuse, you know, to buy a new car, including going out and pounding a nail into my own tire. But it's just, you know.
Well, it's all that money you can burn, John.
Well, this podcast made me, you know, a 10-air.
Yes.
Yes. I make about an extra $10 a month because of the podcast. Actually, no, I don't.
That's your last check.
I would promote my cup that you can't see here because of my green screen. There we go. And that you could buy one, but as Jason knows, they're really not available yet. So that's us ranting about and hopping on some of the latest automotive news.
But there's one thing I wanted to, or I was glad to see came up in the articles here, and that is that some of the car companies are bringing the Memorial Day celebrations back. I mean, most importantly, we need to know when Toyota-thon is, but beyond that, bringing back some Memorial Day sales.
It actually said Toyota's probably the least because they have less than a 30-day inventory. And I saw that picture yesterday, and I'm going, because I've thought it's a good-looking car. I know it's very controversial. But I really like the newest Prius. You know, it's kind of looks like it's got a little wing and the headlights and everything. And there was a picture that came out of one yesterday where it was like this matte gray, and had the 50s era Moon Eyes disc wheel covers on it. And it just looked sleek and aerodynamic. And just, it just looks so, to me, so cool. And I'm going, I wonder how much a new Prius costs. I haven't looked that up. I have a feeling it starts with a 4. But yeah, so I mean, there's a lot of good car news coming out. And with that, I'm going to go to the our webpage, nodrivinggloves.com. And on the right side of the screen, there's a little thing where you can give us your email. Go ahead and give us your email. You're going to get some stickers and some presents. But I've been slowly working on and developing a newsletter for Nose Driving Gloves. And a lot of these little news bits we're going to start hitting. We're going to start hitting on some of these up to the minute topics and happenings and linking to some various articles where we're getting our information. I'm not promising the newsletter is going to be available right away. I'm getting, basically, I've been working on it for 4 or 5 weeks in the background, just making sure that I have set aside the time before announcing it that a newsletter is going to be available. So give us your email, get a little bit more background of No Driving Gloves, and again, get some free gifts and such. Maybe that's where the coffee mugs will first show up.
Very nice. Very nice. And Hernando was jumping right into our next, or at least my next comment, which was the fact that, and John, you covered it a little bit here, you know, Toyota is only looking at about 30 days worth of unsold vehicles as of May 1st of this year, whereas Mercedes has 92 days, Ford has about 100 days, and Jeep and Ram are over 150 days. You know, Hernando says around a 300-day inventory, but you know, I think this is something to pay attention to. Going back to the, you know, Americans don't buy cars thing. I mean, here is, and we talked about this last week, how many cars are sitting on dealership lots? And here's, you know, as they say, the proof is in the pudding. You know,
did I die or
the proof is in the pudding that's sitting in the parking lot, let's call it, because Toyota, which most of their inventory is cars. Yes, they do have trucks, but, you know, Jeep and Ram, SUV and truck manufacturers, somewhere between 150 and 300 days worth of inventory, but people aren't buying cars. Again, let's get this sorted out and be truthful and honest about why we're not making cars and from American companies.
Well, I mean, even looking at, you know, 300 days is still over 150 days inventory. And I might imagine that Hernando might be right in that it could be 300 because the press just doesn't want to put out that number maybe in this article because this, you know, it really looks bad if you're sitting on 1 year. You know what that's going to do to a stock price if that starts becoming common knowledge? But what do they make? Jeep makes Jeeps. You know, and I still can't believe how expensive a Wrangler is. You even a base Wrangler, and then you got, you know, $110,000 Jeep Wrangler 392s, and you know the Grand Wagoneer came out, and every time I saw an ad for it, you know, it was as shown $92,000, as shown $98,000, but they never alluded to that there was a $60,000, you know, that was competitive with a base Suburban or something. They always showed these $100,000 vehicles, and it took a couple months for even me to realize that, hey, wait, I could get one of these for 2/3 of the money that you're advertising that the one on the ad is. I just think Stellantis is lost, and it still goes back to what I've been saying for years. Stellantis doesn't want Ram. Stellantis doesn't want Dodge. Stellantis doesn't want Chrysler. You know, they wanted the Jeep four-wheel drive technology, and, you know, they've got that now. And, you know, maybe they want Ram so they can sell a truck, but they can put all the four-wheel drive technology into Alphas and Maseratis and SUVs. And yeah, the Wrangler's a niche vehicle, but is it? I don't know. I just don't think Stellantis cares about the Chrysler, Dodge, what do I want to say, Ram, Jeep line in their inventory or in their, you know, corporate world. It's sad to say, but I'm still putting, still have a hammer in the, or they still have 1 foot in the grave. The audio listeners will get to hear that in a nice, clear, edited statement.
Nice, clear statement.
Yeah, that's what happens when you go live. But is it time to start talking about some of these golden showers that have been falling?
Well, that took a turn. yes, John. Let's as I said in the beginning, let's bring the bling.
Yes.
24 karat gold plated tiers of a podcaster.
And what's really difficult in researching this topic, it's amazing the number of YouTubers that don't understand what 24-karat gold plated means. Just because you wrapped a car in gold doesn't mean it's a gold car or a gold-plated car or the wraps infused with gold. It's something that can actually be easily seen or noticed if the car's all one perfect shade of gold and all the body panels match, it's a wrap. If you want a good example of it, check out the Peterson Automotive Museum's video on their gold DeLorean and notice how there's some panel color differences and things from the true gold-plated, gold-plated panels to the parts that had to be painted because you can't gold plate plastic, or at least at that time, you really couldn't and do it consistently.
Yeah, technology not quite where it needed to be. So you bring up the DeLorean, John, and I know there's one article we're going to hit on here in a minute, but I think we should jump back and talk about probably the article that I sent you earlier, maybe last weekend, whenever it was, following up on a vehicle we talked about a few episodes ago. I don't remember the exact episode, but if some of our listeners remember, we talked about GM's golden 1955 Chevy Bel Air and the three that were built back in the time period. That way they would have a press car, you know, or a PR type car, movie car, and, you know, one that could travel. And then the real one that was actually the 50 millionth vehicle. And we talked about the fact that a company out of Florida made the tribute version, or, you know, the recreation of the car, got a lot of attention. The press around it was just, to me, not as truthful as it should have been, things like that. It was a little muddied the waters, if you will. And the car sold at auction. And now I cannot find that listing. I don't know why, but
I have the notes in front of me. We did cover the car on episode 345, which would have been late February of this year. And of course, it was the instigator. This Mecum auction is the instigator of the topic for this episode, or the main topic. But before you get into what it sold for, etc., I've spent a lot of time watching some YouTube videos on gold cars and that. And Snodgrass Restorations, which is who, quote, restored this car in their YouTube video that was released sometime in February, they really talk about restoring the car and this detail and that detail and this detail and that detail. And then as we approached, you know, the car debuted and was on public exhibition in early March at, I can't remember what event it was originally debuted at, but things started to creep out that, you know, it wasn't a restoration. It was, you know, a compilation of work by a bunch of individuals, and I'm sure some people's money went into it, and some original parts and some non-original parts. And we really questioned it, especially with the news that was available late February of this year. And by the beginning of this month, just prior to this Mecum auction, a lot of stuff was coming out, and they were clarifying that it wasn't that it wasn't a restoration, that it was a recreation, etc. And I really wanted to compliment the article that you sent me alluding to this auction and what Joe had said about it, Joe Whitaker, who was, I want to say, one of the instigators of this project. I don't know if he's actually one of the hands-on people. I think he might have been actually more of the money behind some of this project. But it's nice to have seen that over a couple of months, and maybe a few people, maybe it was us again, that somebody said, hey, wait a second, we've got a little vagueness in what the news is and what's coming out, and we need to clarify some of this. I'll be quiet again.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to, here we go. So, yeah, so one of my big issues with it was not a restoration. Although I just noted that it did win a award at the Chicago World of Wheels show this year for the best restoration. So maybe the judges want to think about how they're judging that category. And, you know, as John said, one of the builders came out in the auction description and at the auction and actually listed the car in the auction as a 2024 car, not a 1955 car, and made the comment that, you know, it was made from mostly brand new parts, reproduction parts, and all of that. So it was good to see that clarification coming out of, you know, this auction and coming from the builder and, you know, everybody kind of, or at least most of the people behind this. The other thing that shocked me, and I get it, you know, resto mods right now are pretty hot, but this isn't a resto mod. You know, it's got a 55 Chevy Bel Air engine in it. You know, it is a true recreation, reproduction of the 50 millionth Chevy. It sold for $434,500. That's a lot of money for a brand new reproduction car, in my opinion. I'm not sure, John, do you have any thoughts on this? Because I don't see where the value is. I don't see that number.
Well, what Joe Whitaker stated on Facebook in response to, I'm assuming, Richard Earl relation to the GM designer. Harley, he said Earl's the car, the car hammered for $395,000. This is quote Joe Whitaker from his Facebook post. The car hammered for $395,000. So why does the Mecum website show $434,500? Now, Mecum displays the gross selling price, which is hammer price plus 10% buyer's commission, unquote, which to me is the true price. Because if I'm buying the car, I know I'm paying that 10%. So I know I'm paying $435,000 rounded. I'm not paying $395,000. You always have that in the back of your mind, especially when you're bidding six figures on a car. Mm-hmm. And then going back to Joe's statement, quote, and why is the car listed as a 2024 and not a 1955? And Joe admits, well, I guess, unquote, Joe admits, go back to quote, since this is an all new car and not a rebadged original, we registered the car as a new build in the state of Florida, which I was so happy to see him make that disclosure and that clarification. I was so glad to see Mecum list it as a 2024 and didn't say 2024 Chevrolet Bel Air or 1955 Chevrolet Bel Air, 50 millionth car titled as 2024. Everything was on the up and up when it really came down to it, and it was so nice to see. Now, as Derek said, $435,000 is a lot of money for this car, and I questioned it, but then I went in and Motor Trend actually did an article on this car on May 9th, just prior to the auction. And here's some facts about this car. They spent a ton of time to try to get proper date coded stuff. So this car is as close to being the car as possible. This car contains an October 1954 dated Delco front spiral shocks. It contains the original front coil springs and rear leaf springs from one of these three 1955 Golden Chevy 50 millionth cars. It contains the original rear spiral shocks. It contains the five original riveted 15x5-inch steel wheels from one of these, one of these original cars. So there are some original pieces on it. Of course, it does have, you know, new Coker tires on it, optional deluxe heater, optional electric windshield wiper motor. I'm assuming the car has the actual windshield wiper blade or arms, because that's where this whole process and idea came from. It has the original, or excuse me, it has a September 1954 dated radiator. It has a November 1954 dated voltage regulator. So they did go through a little bit of effort to try to find original pieces to put on this or properly date coded pieces. One of the videos I watched about this car, they pointed out that the radiator core support is actually a little bit different on an early 1955 Chevy than a later 55 Chevy. And there are certain little things that have to be, they did their best to make it absolute to this car. The paint that was applied to this car, they make it sound expensive, but to be honest, I think red costs a little bit more because I think they said the paint here was $350 a quart, which would come up to, what, $1,400 a gallon. And to be honest, some reds get up to that price also. But it was painted with 5.5 gallons of this paint. So it does add a little bit. And then, like they say, 150 to 200 parts of the original stainless, the original chrome, that kind of polished metal that would have been on the car were actually gold plated. And gold's $2,000 an ounce right now. So I think the effort that went into this, the story behind this car might lend to that. Will you be able to resell this car for that much money in a year or 2 years? I don't know if this is going to be a profit. Any money you make is probably due to inflation more than appreciation of this vehicle. But where are you going to get another one for that kind of money? I bet you, I don't know. Did we ever find out how many hours went into building this car?
I haven't been able to find that yet.
I thought I saw it, or maybe he said it in the video.
I know I saw the 3,000 hours of like research and, you know, between finding the parts and, you know, doing the research to get photos and documents and things. I saw that. I didn't see any commentary overall.
And I believe even in the video, Snodgrass said what we've spent the last, you know, 3,000 hours or so. But it says after, you know, the article's after tons, over 3,000 hours of archival research, etc. But if you figure even best case scenario, say this car 2,000 hours to build because you didn't have to do any metalwork because it was a new body, etc. At $150 an hour or something, you still got $300,000 into just the basic work, not including the lineage that's been created about this car and the provenance, because the, you know, one of the original cars that was purchased at a dealership, et cetera, and was brought to North Carolina and become a race car, and that was in a barn fire in 96 or something, and then scattered. You know, there's really no doubt to the lineage that some of these parts are real to this car. I mean, from a museum standpoint, I'm sure Derek has a lot of comments on it. But from a collector standpoint, from a one up in your Tri-Fi Chevy buddy, when you're playing with, you know, 9-10 figure bank accounts, how are you going to top this car?
Yeah, I don't know. Probably the car from Tulane Blacktop and American Graffiti. I'd much rather have that car.
I don't know. I mean, those are my thoughts.
Yeah.
So. This is a written. This one's
you know, as you say, John, I have a lot of comments. I'm actually, I guess, if from the museum standpoint, it's. And I would think almost from a collector standpoint, maybe I'm just an odd duck in the world of collector vehicles and antique vehicles, but part of me almost feels that it is a shame that some of the original parts are inside this vehicle. Maybe had they tried to find the closest VIN number car that was original GM sheet metal and used that as their basis, which we talked about in the episode we talked about this on, that was one of my points, it would feel more appropriate. But part of me almost feels like it's a disservice to those original parts to be on a completely reproduction sheet metal body. I feel like that almost takes away from the significance of those parts. And that's just me, right? That's just my approach to historic vehicles and their importance. But the fact that, you know, oh, these original parts are in this car, part of me almost feels like it'd be better if they weren't and they were just nicely displayed with the car on the side.
I can go with you. And when I first read some of this, I thought that's what they meant, is that some of these parts were displayed with the car. And I think some of the original parts are actually, you know, some of the mechanical ones that probably were too corroded or damaged to be used are still with the car. But if you look at the way, you know, this car was forgotten, you know, the first two of the three were lost almost immediately. And this other one just, you know, somehow gets scattered around a North Carolina farm. I don't understand that part. But by them acquiring and doing this project, at least all the parts are together. And you can go in and, I guess, see the parts. You know, I'm sure they shot blasted, sand blasted, soda blasted, some sort of media blasting to these parts and cleaned them up and repainted them and refinished them and everything else for the, you know, car. So some of that is gone. They omitted in one of the videos that I saw about this car, you know, there was no paint code. The paint was one off, as he said, but technically it was three off. So they're not even 100% sure this is the exact right color of gold on the car. But based on photographs, and I mean, even I at the Barber Museum used black and white photographs and colorizing programs to prove the color of, you know, shades of vehicles. So I'm pretty sure they got the color right. But I think, you know, what's the difference if I display these, say springs?
The shocks.
If I display the shocks in the car, installed in the car, or I display them in a cool black glass case next to the car. I'm honestly asking that question. You, as a museum person, can you tell me what the difference might be? You know, this car will never be driven. So,
yeah, I mean, so to me, the other thing about this is, and this will be a roundabout way of answering your question, I think, John. Yeah. Let's start with what makes the part of the 50 millionth car. Okay. Where is the provenance? Where is the proof and the evidence that it was that part, right? Because it comes out of a big bin of parts, right? These shock absorbers, somebody grabs one out and it's going to be for that car, okay? Or the wiper blades or whatever it is. So on some of these parts, what makes them original to this significant 50 millionth car? It would be the gold paint or gold plating that is applied to them, and that original surface that was applied to make it the 50 millionth car. So you go to restore the car, well, restore the parts that are going into the recreation of the car, and you want them all to look beautiful, just like the rest of this recreation. They're going to do exactly what you said, John. You're going to strip those original parts down. You're going to restore them and you're going to repaint them so they match to make them look right on the car. We just erased every ounce of history that they were the car. They could be any other shock absorber out of the bin that came out of, because the significance of that part, the proof of that part on this car was the color. It was nothing else. They weren't special parts. They weren't custom made for this car. The only distinguishing factor is the finish. So once you strip it, it's no longer that. It's no longer the part from the 50 millionth car, because you have no evidence anymore that it was. So by leaving them in the condition that shows the original paint surface or original plating, that is the proof that this is a part off the 50 millionth. You display that in an exhibit case. That's where the provenance steps in. That is where the story lives. It's in the finishes on this car. And that's the way we have to approach artifacts. Any artifact that we're looking at in the museum world, and in my opinion, any artifact that a collector is looking at, you need to determine what makes it the artifact. What is that distinguishing, part of the evidence and part of the story that makes it what it is? Because once you erase that, then you've erased its history. So a long roundabout way of it, John, but I think that's the difference. Leaving it with whatever original surface is left so you can prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that this is the part, these are the parts, is way more important than, yeah, we stripped them, sandblasted them, and we put them in the car. Well, okay, are they really the part then? Do you see where I'm headed with that, John?
Well, I can see where you're headed with that. And I guess strictly 100% speaking, in a museum world, there is that we strip it, refinish it, destroy it. I go back to the Lotus 25 Junior that we acquired. It could have been a 25. Maybe it was. I don't know. It was a 1960-61 Lotus Junior Formula Junior car, and I can't remember which model. And we bought it out of a collection, and the car had been raced in the 1961 race season and put away and never touched again. And when the museum acquired that, I convinced the museum, we're going to do a preservation. We're not going to change any of the finishes. We're not going to change any of the damage. We're going to clean it up for display because our benefactor would not allow it to be displayed with the dust and everything else on it. And when I disassembled that car, I took notes to how the hex bolts, what hex bolt or what bolt came out of what hole, not just that these are the engine bolts or that these are the chassis, whatever bolts. This bolt came from this hole and this bolt came from this hole, with a photograph of, the head placement and how the hex was oriented to its surroundings. And when I reassembled the car from the portions that I had to disassemble to clean, it went back together as close to possible. Now, the motor was, I pulled the motor out, same painstaking note-taking, turned it over to another one of our team who was tasked with making it run, because that was something that the Barber Museum is known for, is that all the exhibits would operate. First thing I saw him do is tear down the motor, throw it in the hot tank, and everything. Why did I take all these notes? Why did I spend days and days and days for him to throw it in a hot tank? So the motor of that car is totally restored, totally painted, not a ounce. So I understand where you're coming from on that point. But it's that, I guess it goes back to, and that could be a whole episode topic, museum versus collector, because a collector wants it pretty and clean, and the majority of collectors want it pretty and clean, etc. Even to the point that people compete in the preservation class will take car A that's absolutely original, blah, 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 but the interior is worn out, and by car A, and because it has a better interior, and then combine the two so that they can win the preservation class because they have the best preserved car, even though they've swapped parts. So it does, car collecting, or, well, it goes back to car collecting in the museum world clash in so many ways. And this 55 Chevy is a perfect example of, I think, that clash. I think we've touched on the conversation before. I don't think you'd see that problem in the art world or Waterford Crystal world, or, you see it in cars, and I guess you see it in watches. But do you see it in a lot of other, collecting worlds?
I think I've brought it up on the show before. It was pretty big in the furniture world. In say the early 1900s into the mid century, and then in about the 1970s and early 80s, a number of furniture collectors, and a few of those furniture collectors I knew very well while I was in Cleveland, you know, they stepped up and they were like, "Hey guys, we got to stop this. We're erasing the history of all of this." So the furniture world actually made a great, the collector furniture world made a great transition in the 1970s and 80s to not messing around with stuff and letting it be and letting its story live on. So, you know, that's one that's the one I always reference back to.
Yeah. And I would say I'm a member of a few Herman Miller groups and that, but I still see the same thing there is, how do I fix this? How do I fix that? You know, oh, they ruined this. And, and I guess it's a lot of that mid-century modern stuff or whatever that I guess I'm thinking and maybe overlapping, because we have our people that want to go into a Frank Lloyd Wright house and just, oh, let's change this and change that and change this to update it to be more modern. And then the true mid-century modern purists just absolutely throw a fit. But I guess maybe it's not quite mid-century modern, but the Brady Bunch house that, you know, HGTV recreated, or actually created for the first time and then gave away, etc. Whoever won it hated it because it wasn't livable in today's world. And maybe that, you know, that's an extreme, but to swing it back to cars, we are in that clash of museum world to this Tri-5 Chevy, which was right, which was wrong. And we've obviously spent one episode on February 29th debating this or discussing it. And we're kind of doing it again here, except with a lot more information. And the fact that it's been much more open about the condition of this car and what's going on with this car, et cetera, that I can be a little bit more comfortable with the existence of this car in the way it is. I have a feeling you probably are a little bit more comfortable. There's obviously some things that you as a museum professional would do or would have done differently. And I can agree with a lot of what you say as somebody who has played in the museum world, but it's also one of the arguments or discussions I always had with the people in the company that I worked for when I was doing a lot of museum conservation. And what's the limit? How far do we go? And how far do we go? How far can we go? How far should we go to balance that? What the general public wants is to see, the Titanic and it's all its glory, all perfectly preserved, blah, blah, blah. They don't want to see this rusted, corroded, falling apart shell or whatever, crustacean infested thing that it is now, which is what history has brought it to. And the proof of that is the guy in Australia building a new Titanic, because we all want to see the Titanic. We don't want to see the Titanic. We want to see the Titanic in our minds. And I think that's where this 55 Chevy lands, is we wanted to see what this car looked like. And we wanted, is it Jim? I can't think of his name. I got to look at the text from you again.
I think it was Joe Whitaker.
Yeah. That, you know, Joe and Snodgrass and a couple of other people that were involved, and I'm sorry, I can't recall any of their names, what they thought the world should see. And this is that fine point. I've always said, you know, Will used to allude to when he told somebody at McPherson College, one of the advisory board, that, oh yeah, we're cutting up a Lincoln Zephyr, and the guy about had a heart attack because he's cutting up a Lincoln Zephyr. Well, my argument's always been, unless it is the absolute last Lincoln Zephyr on the planet, you can do whatever the hell you want with it, because you came up with the money first. If you really want, if you really don't think it should be done, you need to buy one yourself and not let that be done to it, or buy them all. But this obviously is a one of one. And the parts were one of one. But looking at the pictures of how the parts were recovered, I don't think if these five or six guys didn't come along, these parts would have just wasted away to nothing. So, you know, when it comes down to refinishing and putting on this recreation or leaving B and leaving history, I'm happier that they're on the recreation and the story and the documentation is still there, that they're the correct parts as opposed to the story and Mother Nature being the caretakers of this. So that's my opinion, and you and I differ on some opinions, and this might be as vocal and differing maybe as we've ever been on the show.
But I don't know about that, John. I'm just, you know, the other thing I always have to take into consideration is the historic context of it, or the historic relevance. And, you know, if I was to really sit back and, you know, somebody was to really press this topic, I don't know that this car is historically relevant enough to really care. It was the representative 50 millionth Chevrolet, you know, and is it really something that is extremely historically important to get really worked up over? No, not really. Not in my opinion.
Well, as we discussed in the previous episode, there were three of these 50 millionth cars. You know, one was built long before the 50 millionth General Motors car was built, for publicity photos and exclusively to film the video of the car being constructed. And one was built to tour the country. And that's the one that appears to still have parts exist. And then one was built, the actual 50 millionth car was built, rolled out of the factory, mounted to a parade float, and disappeared shortly thereafter. So, even to General Motors, to me, it wasn't that important of a thing. It was enough to invest, maybe an extra, $25,000, $1,955 into, an extra whatever, so that they could get the publicity. And, of course, it would be a tax write-off at that point, too. So it really didn't matter to them. And then they just pushed these cars to aside. Like I said, this car in question, the parts that were used on it, according to the story, it was put on a used car or a Chevrolet, sold to a Chevrolet dealer as a used car. The Chevrolet dealer in Chicago resold it, and it ended up in North Carolina, where the gentleman who bought it was going to take it apart, build it into a race car, as the story goes. And he never got around to it. And then again, the barn caught fire and the car was forgotten. And to be honest, even Joe probably would have never thought about doing this project until he was approached by one of the brothers or the son of the guy who bought it to make it into a race car, and said, "Hey, you want to buy these windshield wiper arms?" And the story goes, money was crazy. So Joe turned him down, but later on he was talking to another Tri-Fi guy, and the guy goes, "Hey, I'm kind of interested in that." And that other guy ended up buying the wiper arms. And that's where I think this article probably ended up coming from. This project ended up coming from, was, you know, them getting together. But if somebody wouldn't have approached somebody about, "Hey, do you want to buy these gold plated wiper arms from a 55 Chevy?" This car would have been just forgotten to history, and, you know, would just been another blip. I mean, it would be just as important as, what do I want to say? You know, just pick something. I'm going to say a Pontiac GTO in the 1963 or 64 Pontiac commercial where the Tiger comes out of the hood. Where the hell is that car? Is that, you know, is that an important car? I don't, you know, is that car, this car, any more different than something like that? So, you know, yeah, it's a neat story. It's a cool car. Like I said, if you're a Tri-Fi collector with, you know, a 9 or 10 figure bank account, this is probably something you need to have in your collection, which explains the $435,000 selling price. There's obviously two people in the room that wanted the car that bad that, you know, if you're Jeff Bezos, $434,000 is like you adding extra pepperoni to a pizza, not even just buying the pizza, just like add an extra pepperoni for $2 to your pizza. It means, you know, that much money means nothing to them. It's sickening to say that some people are in that position, but, and this isn't a comment on wealth or anything, but some people are like that. Some people have that much money. So it's just who has the bigger dick in the room, or drank the most. Probably the one that has the least alcohol tolerance in the room is where it goes to. Dang,
your phone keeps going off, John.
Say that's my 60-minute timer.
Yeah, that's the timer. So I think that's going to wrap it up for the night, John. Wouldn't you agree?
I think so. I mean, it was a pretty good episode. I mean, we really, once we learned more about the story, and more of the story came out and people started to step up. I think the two episodes combined, let me go back here and get my episode number, episode 345. What you see isn't what you get was the name of that episode from February 29th, 2024. It was when we first discussed the 50 millionth car GM sold. And today where we discussed what happened after the car was sold at auction and how the truth, I don't want to say the truth because I don't know if they were lying, but
let's call it the full story.
Yeah. The whole story came out. I don't honestly believe they were lying because even watching the video, when they were first introducing the car at the restoration shop, the guy was just talking about it like a car. And you know, we did this and we did that, and you could take, yeah, maybe you made a sound like it was all original and that, but who knows? You know, it wasn't a carefully constructed, it was more of an just off the cuff conversation like we have here on No Driving Gloves every week, which you should like and subscribe to the YouTube channel and catch us live, or subscribe to the podcast at nodrivinggloves.com and catch the episodes every week. They're going to begin to probably start dropping on Monday. I found a flaw with dropping them on Friday, even though I want to get them out as quick as possible to you. There's an advantage to getting to you on Monday morning. If you are against that, send me a note. We don't necessarily have to change. Anything else for this evening, Derek, or shall we call it?
I think on the topics, John, I am all talked out. So guys, as John said, if you like what you hear, go over, follow us on the social medias, give us a like. Heck, scan the QR code you see here on the screen, buy us a coffee or two or 10 or 20, whatever you, I like coffee. So, and beyond that, if you like what you hear, if you want to see No Driving Gloves grow, if you want to see the No Driving Gloves community grow, we want to see more comments in the comment section on these live broadcasts. Guys, help us grow, share the show. And with that, have a great day, night, evening, whatever it is.
And as Derek said, best thing you can do, I don't care, don't scan that QR code. Tell a friend about us. Get it out there. If you're watching us on YouTube or Facebook Live, give us a like, give us a share there. That really helps the show. If you want to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or et cetera, you can do that. Really, that really doesn't help the show. Makes us feel good, but that doesn't help the show. But a like and a share on Facebook or YouTube really does us good. And with that, it's time to get off your ass, go burn some gas, because John is out.